We're continuing our study in the 26th Psalm. In this Psalm, the writer has some thoughts that are very close to all of us because we all have these thoughts ourselves if we're trying to please God. He is asking God to judge him, to examine him, to prove him, to try him, to see whether or not he be acceptable in the sight of God. Now, of course, this writer feels that he is acceptable. He feels that he is a follower of the true God and doing it in the way that God would have him to do. But there is a chance that he might be wrong. There's a chance that he might not be acceptable. So he asked God to put him to the test, to try and see if he truly is following in the paths that God would have him to follow. And since he's doing all that he knows to do to be acceptable to God, then the next step here is to have God then to put him to the test, to try him, to judge him, to place his case before the bar of justice, and to see whether or not he truly is living in the acceptable way. Now, since he does believe that he is acceptable, he gives God then several reasons why he feels that he is acceptable. He gives reasons why he feels that he has evidence that he is a righteous person. He says in verse 3, "For thy loving kindness is before mine eyes, and I have walked in thy truth. I have not sat with vain persons, neither will I go in with dissemblers. I have hated the congregation of evildoers, and will not sit with the wicked. I will wash mine hands in innocency, and so will I compass thine altar, O Lord." So he simply states here that he is not a person who has made his company with those that are evil, or those that are vain, those that are secretive or hypocritical. He has hated the congregation or the assembly of the evildoers. He will not sit with them. He's worshipped God in such a way that he'd washed his hands in innocency. That is, he was free of sin, free of guilt, and he would encompass the altar of God this way. That is, he would embrace it, or he would walk around it this way as he rendered this worship. And so he's giving here reasons why he feels that he is a righteous person. He's giving the evidence that appears to him to make his case a good, solid case. And so that's where we left off in our last study, at the end of the sixth verse. So now we'll begin with verse 7, where he says, as he continues to make his case, "That I may publish with the voice of thanksgiving and tell of all thy wondrous works." This verse begins with the word "that." And so it means that it is a continuation of what was said in the sixth verse, where he talks about washing his hands in innocency and so encompass thine altar, O Lord. There he is talking about how he worships God in a pure and innocent way, and in a fervent way. He is paying attention to the things of God. But he does this, he worships this way, that he may publish with the voice of thanksgiving. That he's going to tell about God. He's going to publish the things of God. He's going to spread the news about God. He's going to publish with the voice, and it's going to be the voice of thanksgiving. That is, it's going to be a story about God that is going to be intermingled, intertwined with thanksgiving. He is so appreciative of the things that God has done that to just tell about God is going to provoke a thanksgiving to God. To simply mention the fact that there is a God would have to be incorporated with the idea that we are thankful to this God. We appreciate what God has done. "So that I may publish with the voice of thanksgiving and tell of all thy wondrous works." He's going to tell all the things that he knows about God. Tell of all the wondrous works of God. And this is a part of the evidence now that he gives that he is righteous, that he is acceptable. And that is that he is passing on to others the knowledge of God. As he tells of all the wondrous works of God, this would include the creation of God, the providence of God, the things that he does in a day-by-day dealing with us, our next breath of air, our next meal, the very next blessing that we get, whatever it may be, however large, however small. This is a part of God's divine providence. This is part of his wondrous works. And then also, as he tells about these wondrous works of God, he would include his great salvation. And certainly we today, as we have more information even now than the psalmist did, we would be publishing this plan of salvation. So a part of the character of the righteous person, a part of the proof of his holiness and acceptability to God, is going to be that he will be publishing about God. He'll be publishing with the voice of thanksgiving. He'll be telling of all thy wondrous works. And that's the evidence that the psalmist leaves here. So not only does he worship God in the proper way and with innocency, but he also uses his voice, uses the voice of thanksgiving to tell of all the wondrous works of God. Verse 8, continuing now with this idea, of giving reasons why he feels that he is justified. Lord, I have loved the habitation of thy house and the place where thine honor dwelleth. As the writer of this psalm spoke this, this no doubt had a strong reference to the place where the worship was given, which would have been the tabernacle, later the temple itself. And as we apply it today to our lives, it would mean that we have a love for any place where God is acceptably worshipped, wherever this may be. We do not have a place today in the world that is the place where God dwells, like they had back during the time this psalm was written. We do not have one place that's a geographic location that is the dwelling place of God, like the temple or like the tabernacle. However, we do have the church, and God does dwell in the church. Wherever the church is, wherever the church is acceptable, wherever the church is truly carrying out the will of God, there we're going to have the habitation of God. That's going to be the habitation of thy house. That's going to be the place where thine honor dwelleth. That's going to be where God is, where God is found. And so we're going to love those places, which means we're going to love those occasions of worship to God. However many there may be, however few there may be, however humble the surroundings may seem to be, we're not going to be in a place with walls lined with gold, but we're going to be in a place that is spiritually the dwelling place of God. And so he's simply saying that one of the evidences of my holiness and of the fact that I feel that I can be tried before you is that I do render worship to you, and I do love to be in the place where you are. I have loved the habitation of thy house. I love the place where thine honor dwelleth. I love to be where God is. And so this means for us today that we're going to love to be in a state of worship to God. We're going to love to be worshiping, serving, carrying out the acts of devotion to Him that He's prescribed for us to do. So as we assemble to carry out this worship to God, we're going to love it. We're going to enjoy it. We're going to be devoted to it. We're going to be one that is dedicated and truly sincere as we carry these acts of devotion out to God. This will include our singing, our praying. It will include our teaching the Word of God in the assembly of the church. It will include our communion as we bring about a remembrance of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. So we'll not be there because we feel constrained to be. We'll not be there because it's a legalistic rule that we do this, but we're there because we love it. We're there because we want to be there. We love the habitation of thy house and the place where thine honor dwelleth. And if we truly have this feeling, this attitude, then we can say, along with the psalmist, that this is one of the reasons, one of the proofs that we truly are righteous and that we truly do serve the true God. Now that he's given several reasons why he feels that he is righteous, he's given evidences of his hope and of his faith. He begins in verse 9 to express his wish to be found among the righteous. And the first thing he says about that is, gather not my soul with sinners, nor my life with bloody men. The word gather means to bring together, or to congregate, or to accumulate, or even to harvest. And my soul means me, myself. And so what he's saying here is to not put him in the same class with sinners. Do not accumulate me, do not congregate me, do not bring me together with sinners. And this doesn't necessarily just mean after this life, in the place of the habitation of the dead, or in the place of those that are going to be punished in the future life, but it's talking about all aspects of himself. Whatever condition he may be in, whatever position he may be in, whatever place, he is saying, do not classify me among the sinners. Do not gather my soul with sinners. And that would include this life. It would include the everyday walks of this life. It would include the worship that he gives to God. It would include his times of pleasure as well as his times of stress. It would also include death, the habitation of the wicked dead as contrasted with the habitation of the righteous dead, and would include also the life after the judgment. But the next phrase, nor my life with bloody men, and that word does mean life, truly, and it's not talking about just himself, but it's talking about his condition after death. I do not want to be classified with, nor placed in the same category or position as those that are counted as bloody men. Bloody men are those who would, of course, commit murder or violence, thieves, robbers, and what have you. And it's a general term to be used for those that are ungodly, those that are unrighteous. And so what he's simply saying in verse 9 is, do not classify me as being in the same category as those that are sinners, or as those that are bloody men. I don't want to be classed with them in this life. I do not want to be mistaken for one of them. I do not want to be considered to be like them, nor do I want to be classified with them after this life. My soul, my life, do not put it in the same condition that the sinners are in. And here again, as we said before, this is a wish that he is expressing, that he be found among the righteous. And of course, to be found among the righteous means we're going to have to be absent from, away from, different from those that are not righteous. And this thought should be a very great incentive for us today to want to keep ourselves purified, to want to keep ourselves separate, to want to remain in a condition that is not the same as that of the sinners and of the bloody men. Of course, a person doesn't have to actually shed blood to be classified as a bloody man, simply to have the thoughts, the motives, the desires that would be similar to those that shed blood could put you in that same classification. Just not to love your neighbor could be equivalent to being a bloody man in the eyes of God. So we see then that it is an appropriate thing for us to want to be separate from sinners, for us to want to be different from sinners, for us to not want to be mistaken for a sinner, to go out of our way to be classified as one who is different from those that are sinners or bloody men. We want our condition after this life to be one that is a different condition from those of sinners. When we die, we don't want to sorrow as those who have no hope. We want to be among those who have hope, those who have comfort, because our situation in the presence of God is not the same as the condition of the sinner. So the cry here is, do not classify me, do not gather my soul with, do not put my life with the sinners, nor with the bloody men. Now that he's mentioned sinners and bloody men, and how that he doesn't want to be gathered with them, nor accounted among them, he gives a further description of them in the next verse, in the 10th verse. In whose hands is mischief, and their right hand is full of bribes. This word here for mischief really means wickedness. So they are the ones who do wickedness. Either they do it, or the fruits of their efforts produces wickedness. And their right hand is full of bribes. Of course, the right hand is the hand that is the most active, and whatever you find in the right hand, you're going to find the most of in the way of works or fruits. But in their right hand is full of bribes. And the word here for bribes really means a gift that would be given to a judge or someone in authority to keep him from bringing about justice, to bribe him to do the wrong thing. And so these are people then that are guilty of sin in that they commit wickedness, they do mischief, they do have a character that could be corrupted or that might be corruptible, and these are the ones he does not want to be associated with. Of course, in our day, we see that these conditions of men are rampant. All around us, there are those who can be corrupted for a bribe. There are those who have their hands full of mischief. They are guilty of all kinds of wickedness and sins, and they seem to have no thought about it. They have no qualms about it, no conscience of it. They're not worried about it, yet they flagrantly and openly disobey God. These are the kind of people that the writer of the psalm doesn't want to be counted among. He does not want to be mistaken for them. And so he says to gather not my soul with sinners nor my life with bloody men. In verse 11, he begins to give a contrast now between him and those that he's just described. A contrast between himself and the sinners. Verse 11 says, but as for me, I will walk in mine integrity. Redeem me and be merciful unto me. In making this contrast between himself and the sinners he just mentioned, instead of having hands that are full of mischief and the right hand full of bribes, instead of being a sinner, a bloody man, He says, I will walk in mine integrity. And the word integrity here really means to have perfection or to have a state of being blameless. I'm going to do the very best that I know to do. I'm going to walk within the realm of all that I know to be what is right. I'm not going to flagrantly or willingly violate any of these great principles. I'm going to walk in a condition in which I will be genuine, in which I will be honest. It'll be mine integrity, that is, the very best that I can produce for righteousness. And so this is quite a contrast between those that are sinners. They're not doing the best they can. They are not doing the thing that they really know to be right, but they openly, willingly, flagrantly violate the commands of God. So he says, I will walk in mine integrity. That's the condition that I'm in. That's how I want to be known. But he now further elaborates upon this, that there's a semicolon after the word integrity, and he says, redeem me and be merciful unto me. The very fact that he asks for redemption, that he asks God to redeem him, still teaches very strongly that even though he's doing the very best that he can, even though he's walking in this state of what he considers to be perfection, he knows that he falls short. He falls short of the mark of being truly perfect, of being truly righteous in every way, of being one who is justified by his own deeds. And so he asks God then for redemption. Redeem me and be merciful unto me. And any time we ask God for mercy, we're asking God to extend to us a forgiveness, to forgive us, to overlook, to not charge against us those shortcomings, those sins that he might be able to charge us with. So there still must be, in the most righteous of persons, there must be this element of mercy extended by God. For God to give mercy means that he does not accuse us of sin, or he does not hold the sin against us. He forgives us of sin. And so there must be this element of forgiveness. No person can say, I am holy and righteous in every respect, and I have no need for God to forgive me anymore because I'm not guilty of anything. We all stand guilty, and we all must have this mercy of God. But there's a tendency on the part of man to say, well, if God must extend mercy to me, then why not just sin all that I want to? Why not sin as much as I care to sin, and then let mercy abound, let grace abound, let God use all the mercy that he wants to? But that's not the proper attitude. We must do all that we can to keep from sin. We must not willingly, flagrantly, promiscuously sin, because in order to stay in this realm of grace, this realm of mercy, we have to do our very best to obey God. We must truly have a fear of him. We must truly have a conscience of sin and do our best to keep ourselves clean. But once we are in that state of walking in our integrity, walking in this condition that's blameless to the very best of our ability, we still beg God to redeem us. We still ask God to be merciful unto us. And as we know, when God gives us mercy, what he is doing, he is holding back the punishment that we deserve to have by giving us forgiveness of our sins. And we all, whenever we get to that great judgment day, are going to have to cry for mercy to make up for those things that we fall short in truly living a holy and perfect life. In the 12th verse, he further describes his condition. My foot standeth in an even place, and the congregations will I bless the Lord. This statement, my foot standeth in an even place, probably means that he now is walking on level ground. He's now walking in a path that is straight, that is right, that is correct, and he is secure in this path. He no longer is wandering or searching over the hilly, uneven ground. He no longer has to go down into the valleys or climb over the hills or go on the crooked and rough way and search for the truth. He's found the truth. He knows who the true God is. He has a law to follow. He has a plan that is a plan for him to be acceptable to God. And so he's staying with this. He's walking in the straight and narrow path. He's walking in the path of God, but it is a level or even place. He is secure here. He further says, in the congregations will I bless the Lord. This word for congregation simply means the assemblies. He's going to be found with God's people. Wherever God's people assemble, this is where he wants to be. He wants to assemble with the rest of God's people, and there he wants to render the proper worship to God. There will I bless the Lord. so that his religion then is not just a strictly private, personal thing between him and God, but he has a relationship with other members of the family of God. He wants to be with them. He wants to assemble with them in these assemblies. Then this would be known as the congregations. There is where he wants to be, and there is where he will bless the Lord. He also strongly implies that this is where the even place is. This is where the right place is. This is where you're going to have stability and security, is to be meeting with the people of God and their assembling with them. And of course, we know today that we are commanded to not forsake the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, which he states in Hebrews 10:25, so that we do carry out regular assemblies. We do associate ourselves in these assemblies for the purpose of blessing the Lord. That is, for the purpose of carrying out the right kind of worship to God. As a matter of fact, we assemble no less than each first day of the week, and there we carry out several items of worship, including prayer, teaching, singing, and the commemoration of the Lord's death in the communion service. And so we, as this psalmist, will not forsake the assembling of ourselves together. This is where the even place is. This is where our foot can be on a stable, sturdy ground, and there is where we're going to bless the Lord. So we bring this 26th Psalm to an end. We find that it has some very powerful thoughts, things that are most applicable to us today, things that make us the better for having learned about them and taking them and applying them to our lives. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.